Alma and I spent the day together, visiting the Art Institute, digging old photos out of my closet, and visiting the supermarket. We didn't speak much about our father, though. It was as if our conversation stopped whenever we threatened to skirt his memory. It was only that night, after dinner and a long walk along the lake's crumbling breakwall, that we both sensed we couldn't go any further until we opened up the subject. I made us some tea, and Alma began to tell me about the old man, at least what she could remember. "I can't say I really knew him, Barak," she began. "Maybe nobody did. Not really. His life was so scattered. People only knew scraps and pieces, even his own children. I was scared of him. You know, he was already away when I was born, in Hawaii, with your mom, and then at Harvard. When he came back to Kenya, our oldest brother, Roy, and I were small children. We had lived with our mom in the country, in Alego, up until then. I just remember that he came back with an American woman, named Ruth, and that he took us from our mother to go live with them in Nairobi. I remember that this woman, Ruth, was the first white person I'd ever been near, and that suddenly she was supposed to be my new mom. In those first years, the old man was doing really well, you see. He was working for an American oil company, Shell Oil, I think. It was only a few years after independence, and the old man was well connected with all the top government people. The vice president, ministers, they would all come to the house sometimes and drink with him and talk about politics. He had a big house and a big car, and everybody was impressed with him because he was so young, but he already had so much education from abroad. Ruth, our new mother, was nice enough to us then. She treated us almost like her own children. Then things began to change. When Ruth gave birth to our other brothers, Mark and David, her attention shifted to them. The old man, he left the American company to work in the government, for the Ministry of Tourism. He may have had political ambitions, and at first he was doing well in the government. But in 1966 or 67, the divisions in Kenya had become more serious. President Kenyatta was from the largest tribe, the Kikuyus. The Luos, the second largest tribe, began to complain that Kikuyus were getting all the best jobs. The vice president, Ondinga, was a Luo, and he said the government was becoming corrupt. Then instead of serving those who had fought for independence, Kenyan politicians had taken the place of the white colonials, buying up businesses and lands that should be redistributed to all the people. A popular Luo minister, Tom Mamboya, was killed by a Kikuyu gunman. Luos began to protest in the streets, and the government police cracked down. People were killed. Most of the old man's friends just kept quiet and learned to live with the situation. But the old man began to speak up. He would tell people that tribalism was going to ruin the country, and that unqualified men were taking the best jobs. His friends tried to warn him about saying such things in public, but he didn't care. He always thought he knew what was best, you see. When he was passed up for a promotion, he complained loudly. Word got back to Kenyatta that the old man was a troublemaker, and he was called in to see the president. According to the stories, Kenyatta said to the old man that because he could not keep his mouth shut, he would not work again until he had no shoes on his feet. I don't know how much of these details are true, but I know that with the president as an enemy, things became very bad for the old man. He was banished from government, blacklisted. None of the ministers would give him work. Finally, he had to accept a small job with the water department. The job kept food on the table, but it was a big fall for him. The old man began to drink heavily, and many of the people he knew stopped coming to visit, because now it was dangerous to be seen with him.